you may know Chris Acogior, who is one of my law clerks. At one point, she was in the Mecklenburg County Commonwealth Attorney's Office. In order to be completely careful here, I have walled her off from any involvement in this matter. And so I have not discussed it with her in any way. So
it's always good to have South Central Virginia connections. So.
I just wanted to note that for you. And as you know, you have 15 minutes to argue today.
Yes, sir.
Would you like to reserve a portion of that for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I would ask to reserve 3 minutes.
All right. You have it, and there's no rush. We are also getting our papers together, so you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Trent. I represent Barry Ashworth in the proceedings here. And just I think this is in some ways a simple case. This is a sufficiency case. I think it's resolved 100% about whether the evidence was present to prove intent. I view the case as coming down to whether there really is teeth in the really long-standing legal maxim that, generally speaking, fist alone are not sufficient to provide to prove intent to kill, maim, permanently disfigure, or disable. I said kill, and then I went on to maim, permanently disfigure, or disable. I certainly agree with that. At the beginning, I would address the facts just very briefly. I think we're probably going to have competing facts based on the briefs. While I acknowledge that, obviously, all reasonable
inferences. I think that's where you want to go, saying we have competing facts, because if you have competing facts and the trial judge found in favor of the Commonwealth's theory of the facts, then that's not going to put you in a good position.
Actually, I want the court to accept what I think the Commonwealth's finding of the theory of the facts was.
Okay.
There's competing Commonwealth witnesses in this case that have very contradictory statements, at least that's our view of it. There's Mr. Mosley and there's Mr. Evans. In this case, the judge, and I'm relying on what the court said in its ruling. The court said, now I have some other citations, but on 170 of the appendix, the court said, and I'll be honest with you, as the defense indicates, I believe Mr. Evans was a credible witness, I think. I don't think he was impeached in any way, shape, or form. The trial judge also specifically found that, to one level or another, Mr. Mosley was intoxicated. There was testimony of up to 12 beers consumed, certainly close to 12, and we're talking in six to four-hour window, I think, from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m., and based on Mr. Mosley, this happened around 8 a.m., and that he was too intoxicated to drive. That's the reason he had stayed over the night before. So it's our view that Mr. Evans' testimony, where it contradicts Mr. Mosley's testimony, ought to be one this court relies on, and that's because that's when the trial court relied on. I don't think there's any indication at any point that the trial court at any point relied on Mr. Mosley as opposed to Mr. Evans. So that's the version of the facts that I'll argue from, and maybe I'll respond to something different at
the
end.
What injuries did the victim
suffer? Well, that was admitted into evidence, Your Honor. There were some cuts to the face. They were minor, and I've talked about that a lot in the brief. I plan to talk about it a lot here. Accident injuries are really important in this case because when we look at the other situations where this court and the Supreme Court have said this alone are sufficient to justify intent in the surcharge. There's a number of factors the court have looked at. One is the seriousness of the injury. Because while you don't have to succeed in that intent, the seriousness of the injury shows an effort for a greater force, and it goes to the intent.
Okay, what is my answer to my question? What injuries did the victim suffer?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I believe he suffered some cuts to the face, he testified, and a bloody nose. There was testimony of bruises, but there were pictures introduced, and there was no evidence of bruises, and the court, quite frankly, I think was pretty clear from the record, and finding a wounding and talking about the injuries, he was talking about the minor lacerations to the facial area, and the court was very clear in justifying the intent part of the conviction was the headlock. But there is...
Choking in the headlock.
Yes, sir. There was no evidence, though, of injuries related to the headlock. There was just the evidence of what he visually looked like.
Well, there was evidence that he was in and out of consciousness, was there not?
I don't believe there was evidence of actually out of consciousness. I think there was evidence of dizziness, and he sat there for 5 minutes, and we obviously tried to...
Page 29 and 69 to 70.
I'm sorry?
Appendix page 29 and 69 to 70 says what Judge Haley just said.
Okay, well, then I apologize to the court.
And on page 69, it talks about that he was a rather fair-skinned man, Mr. Mosley.
Yes, sir.
And that his face was so red that it got almost dark.
Yes, sir.
Now, the pictures don't indicate that. I've looked at the pictures. They show just a blemish here or there or a slight cut here or there.
Yes, sir.
But, of course, it was a while after, I guess, that the pictures were taken because when the police got to the scene, he wasn't there.
Yes, sir. It was actually, as Mr. Edmonds called the police, Mr. Ashworth was there, and then they went and found him. I think this is where the real crux of the case is how important. We obviously accept the trial court's factual finding on the darkness of the skin and the reasonable inferences from that. But I would submit to the court is that's just simply not enough. You know, we don't have to accomplish the big, bad, and terrible, but what I would submit to the court in a case like this where it's fist alone or hands alone with no weapon, we've always had worse injuries than these. You know, there no actually bad injury came about from the headlock, or at least there was no evidence of that. And what I would submit is there's no evidence that a natural and probable consequence of that headlock actually would be one of these intents, would to be permanently disabled, disfigured, maimed, obviously.
Can I ask you, what seemed to concern him, and I may be wrong about this, so correct me if I am, what seemed to concern Judge Osborne as the fact finder?
Yes, sir.
Was that not only, you know, it wasn't just the punching or the fist punching, but that this occurred after he was unable to fight back. That he had it in the headlock, and I think Mr. Evans testified that at that point he threw it down on the porch, and of course he did let it be at that point. He didn't keep punching him after he was down on the porch, but that at a point before that he couldn't. There had been mutual combat, but at that point he could not fight back after he kept hitting him.
Well, I understand the concern, Your Honor, and I didn't make this explicitly clear in my brief, but I'm not arguing for an outright dismissal. I think an assault and battery is the correct thing here, and an assault and battery means you did something wrong. What I would submit is that to take that next step, we need more than you maybe won the fight and then got a few licks in. What you need is actually some evidence to support that intent. And in this situation, I would argue to the court that the fact is that I have seen in this court's and the Supreme Court's case to argue that we can get beyond the intent is the physical disparity between victims. Admittedly, and this is something I kicked myself a little bit about looking at the record, there's not a lot of evidence about the size of the individuals, but unlike in the Campbell case with the 3-year-old helpless child, and unlike in Shackelford where I think the court described the victim as a frail 50-year-old woman and the other as a man presumably of physical strength. We had two grown men here, and there was no evidence of one being more physically imposing than the other. We've also looked at the serious.
They're the same weight, from what I see in the record.
They're comparable individuals. I mean, I think that's.
Mr. Ashworth was actually 50, and at the time of this, the victim was about 25.
Victim's much younger, yes, sir.
How do you distinguish the facts in this case from Johnson v. Commonwealth, 53 and 30?
Yes, sir. I know the case. I actually think that
And that conviction was for malicious wounding, not unlawful wounding.
Well, I understand. We got into this a little bit at trial. The malice, I understand that some of the same factors we go to whether there's malice, some of there's intent. But I just look at it from the intent standpoint. I actually think Johnson's a good case to look at because, I'm sorry, I need to pull my case up. The case in Johnson is the one with the prosecutor, and there's a blindsided there. I mean, that's one of the factors we've looked at. I mean, there we do a pretty even adults. So I'll acknowledge that in that case, I think it's somewhat on par, but in that case, we have even adults, but one person blindsided the other. There was evidence of premeditation on the part of Johnson, which goes towards you went there with a bad intention, which goes towards you trying to do serious harm. There was a much more serious injury in Johnson, which as the court has said in Johnson as well as other places, I believe.
He had a concussion and several cuts.
Well, and he also... Johnson. Yes, and Yes, I have a concussion. Stitches also. Stitches and a concussion, which is far more extreme than what we have the evidence here in this case. Beyond that, there was also the statements afterwards that showed premeditation. So I think Johnson's very distinguishable. The blindsided nature, the seriousness of the injury, and the premeditation, I think they all go towards someone who had more of a bad act in mind, and that's something the courts looked at a lot. I think the other very important case to look at as far as that I think is probably the closest on point is the Williams case. I mean, at least factually, it feels very similar. The Williams case, obviously, that's where we have that's where the ex-boyfriend broke into the home. And what we have there is the court was really clear that the factors they looked at is the ex-boyfriend came there looking for trouble. In this case, Mr. Ashworth dropped off his wife's dog at her business. In that case, Mr. Williams broke in. In this case, he used his key and went in the back door. In that case, there was a serious injury requiring 5 days in the hospital and treatment until the time of trial. We don't know how long it went on after that. In this case, as the court, I think, referenced, you've seen the pictures. They're very minor injuries. That case ended only after the arrival of the police. This case, Mr. Ashworth got up and walked away. What I would submit to the court is if we look at the factors that this court and the Supreme Court has looked at to decide whether the general rule of fists alone aren't generally enough is overcome, we look at physical disparity. There was none here like there were in those other cases. We look at premeditated bad acts. In Williams, there was because he went there, he broke in. And also in Shackelford, I would argue there was because he went looking to cause trouble with, I think, his estranged wife. We look at seriousness of the injury. Williams, there was 5 days in the hospital.
What do you make of Judge Osborne's apparent finding of fact that Mr. Ashworth was really angry? Now, I know he testified that he, you know, this had happened before.
Yeah, yes, sir.
He found his wife in these situations before, and he just wanted to get this guy out of there.
Well, the court will understand. There's a reason I'm not arguing too much for Mr. Ashworth's trial testimony. I'm sure he was angry. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say that he wouldn't have been angry, even if he had found him before. I think anybody would have been angry. But what I would submit is, I think that whole situation actually kind of goes against this intent. I mean, Mr. Mosley, even his testimony wasn't that I'm going to, like some of these other cases, Shackelford, I believe, as well as the other ones, they're saying, I'm going to kill you or I'm going to get you. In this case, he's like, you need to leave. Don't you know that's my wife? Mr. Evans backed that up. Mr. Evans backed up that he didn't bring him out on the porch and start beating him down. But no, he's throwing him down. And then Mr. Mosley charged either to the door or Mr. Ashworth. I don't think we know that for sure. So what I would submit is when we look at all those factors, yeah, he was angry. But it's what the intent with that anger was the intent to maim, kill, disable, or disfigure, was the intent to get him out of there and get him away from his wife. What I would submit to the court is I'm not afraid of anger. And that's certainly a factual finding, and I think it's a common sense factual finding. I can't argue against that.
Your argument is that, well, you got him out of there, they had mutual combat till he won, and then he left him alone. He left him out there. He didn't do anything else to him.
Yes, sir. I think that's one of many factors. I think the fact that he got up and walked away and left him for 5 to 10 minutes till he left on his own accord, I think that's a pretty good indication of somebody that wasn't actually trying to do harm. He was trying to get him out of the place where he had found the man at 8 a.m. with his wife, drunk and disrobed. I see that I'm at 2:45, so I'd ask to reserve my time.
Reserve the rest of your time. Mr. Warren?
It pleases the court. Rosemary Bourne, on behalf of the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. Look, this is an intense finding of fact. And so unless it's plainly wrong and there's no evidence in the record to support it, this court must affirm the trial court's finding of fact that he had the intent to maim, disable, disfigure, or kill. And certainly there were circumstances in the record that support that finding. First of all, an assault with a bare fist without a weapon is not dispositive. It can support.
I ask you on that, Ms. Bourne, at what point here did appellant's actions cross the line between, you know, a husband getting somebody off of his and his wife's property, obviously angry, but as Mr. Trent said, but getting him out of the property. So at what point did it cross the line between a simple assault and battery and an unlawful one?
where the victim had several injuries. He was in and out of consciousness and was choked to the point that his face turned dark and his oxygen was cut off. Look, this was so severe that the defendant's employee felt that he needed to call the police at that point. I mean, if this was just some sort of punch off because these guys were upset about some infidelity, I don't think he would have called the police. He called the police because he saw the victim being held down and unable to get any oxygen. And that was why, that is what supports the intent here.
The pictures don't show that, but the pictures were taken later.
They were taken later. And of course, the trial court had evidence, had testimony, which it was its job to weigh. With regard to whether there was intent at that moment to maim, disable, disfigure, or kill. And so we're talking about, we know from the Ricks case and the other recent strangulation cases that, you know, cutting off someone's oxygen supply is sufficient for bodily injury. And that is so because it's so dangerous, because it's so dangerous to do that. And here it was not just, you know, a momentary grabbing of the neck. He's got him in a headlock and punching him repeatedly to the point that his face is blood red, dark, as described by the witness. In addition, he had some other cuts and some other injuries and some bruises, according to his testimony, which may have not been supported by what the picture showed. I don't know when the pictures were taken or who took them.
Would you concede that this fight is not enough to get unlawful wounding?
I think it depends on the other circumstances involved. I mean, again, I don't concede here that this was mutual combat. I mean, he may have been trying to go back into the... You know, he was drunk, clearly. I mean, we talk about the disparate...
You don't agree with the characterization that he charged.
Well, he may have been charging... There was some testimony that he may have been charging to go back in. Look, he was drunk, and I think one of the factors to be considered is when people are in disparate positions. Well, and we know from sexual assault context, when people are unable to defend themselves because they're intoxicated, that is something that the court can consider, physical helplessness. This gentleman was apparently pretty physically intoxicated.
Well, that's a consent question.
Right, but I'm just saying that insofar as physical helplessness, and I'm not saying it's the same thing, but this gentleman, I think one of the factors the court could consider was his level of intoxication, and that he, at least at the point where he was being choked, was completely defenseless.
I mean, the men were about the same size, right? And he was actually considerably younger than Ellen.
But even if we have mutual combat, I mean, this is why it's not... all that this stuff negates is malice. The wife, the circumstances about, you know, having... being so angry, that would negate malice, just like in the murder context. If you walk in, it's an, you know, you might have... you might negate malice. And that was negated here. So that's a completely separate issue. He wasn't convicted of malicious wounding. He was convicted of unlawful wounding. And the issue...
So if it weren't for the chokehold and the continued punching during the chokehold, you would say it's an assault and battery?
If it weren't for the chokehold and the continued punching, I think all of the circumstances together show the immediate attack where he throws him out and definitely the chokehold and the punching and the injuries that he's
sustained. So the immediate attack where he throws him out, that would be...
Not sufficient in and of itself. Yeah. No, I would say that certainly the concerning thing, I think, to the court had to do, and the court mentioned this in its finding, had to do with the color of his skin during which time he was being held.
There's all kinds of testimony that he's a blonde guy, very fair. So someone that fair might turn red, much redder, more quickly, too.
Well, I mean, again, these are factual issues that were up to the trial court to determine. And I think that the trial court did so based on the evidence it had before it. And it was not that a decision was not plainly wrong based on the evidence that was before the court. So unless this court has further questions for me, I would just ask that you affirm.
So one last question. What in your mind is the strongest piece of evidence? Maybe it's a combination, but... What would you say is the strongest piece of evidence that the appellant had the requisite intent here? Because clearly, at first, it's man very upset that, or at least somewhat upset, that he found his wife with another man.
And I don't think, I would disagree that that cuts, and I will try to answer your question, Your Honor, I'm not trying to avoid it, but I don't think that that cuts both ways, because it's up to the trial court to determine what impact that that anger had, and certainly it could be interpreted as, well, I'm so angry I'm going to really, really hurt this person. I'm willing to tell you what I think is the strongest piece of evidence, though I don't think that that really matters ultimately. It's what the court thought was the strongest piece of evidence. My opinion means nothing in this court. But certainly I think that...
That's an overstatement, your opinion.
But I...
What is the Commonwealth's position?
The Commonwealth's position. Well, I guess I'm saying this because really... It's not up to the court or me to reweigh this evidence. It's what the trial court considered. And I think that the trial court considered, and I think the strongest piece of evidence, is the choking and the hitting when this person was in a position of vulnerability. At least at that juncture. He was angry. He was very, very angry. He got the guy, the victim, in a position of vulnerability, and he continued to... hit him. I think the testimony was 5 or 10 minutes.
Five or ten minutes.
I mean, that's a long time to be continually punching someone when they're in a position of vulnerability and having their air cut off. And it was so bad that after...
I thought the testimony was that the combat was 5.
No, because the...
punching during the choke hold.
Well, maybe I'm reading it differently. But my understanding was the attack went on for 5 or 10 minutes.
The incident.
Yeah.
One nature or another.
That's a long time for that to be going on. And certainly the characterization by Mr. Evans that of the appearance of the victim during that attack, the way that he appeared to him during that attack, and the fact that the victim said he was dizzy, he had these problems after he was released from the attack, and so forth and so on.
Obviously, the record shows Mr. Evans robbed with Helen, apparently working for Helen.
That's correct. So,
further questions from the board?
For those reasons, I would ask that you affirm.
Just very briefly on the mutual combat, there is evidence in the record by Mr. Evans that he saw at least one punch from Mr. Mosley. As far as the 5 to 10 minutes comment, I think that mostly comes from Mr. Mosley, and for what it's worth, I think Mr. Mosley's testimony was pretty incredible. I think the Commonwealth, that's interesting, at every stage of the proceedings, the Commonwealth's acknowledged he was very intoxicated, but we can listen to that.
Did the trial judge find his testimony incredible?
He didn't say incredible. That was the term I used, but what I would say to the court is at no point did the trial judge rely on Mr. Mosley's testimony for anything. Everything was Mr. Evans' testimony. Sometimes they corroborated each other, but it was never an independent thing. No, he did not find it incredible, but he certainly found him to be heavily impeached. And he also found him to have been intoxicated when this happened. I would submit that the reason mutual combat's important here, and I would agree that normally goes to malice, but the reason it's important here is one of the very important factors when we're looking at intent is if you did something really bad, did you plan it? You know, what was the thought? That's where the case of the blind side and the prosecutor case, that's why that's so important, because it was unprovoked. It just happened. In this case, the headlock, I would agree, is the strongest evidence. And I think that is largely what the trial court relied on in convicting. But I think it's important that was after all of this mutual combat. That's after whatever it was in Mr. Mosley's mind, whether he was trying to get back in or what, he's charging towards Mr. Ashworth. And when we're looking at intents, what's in Mr. Ashworth's mind? So, you know, I think it would be a different situation if Mr. Ashworth had just left and they had argued and then decided to come back and just slam him down to the ground and then put him in headlock. I think the fact that we've been in mutual combat negates the intent. I think it shows that this was an ongoing fluid situation, and it supports the idea that intent was never formed. I guess I'll just wrap up with what I have seen, the factors that the courts have used, and I don't think I got to all of them, but Maybe I did. But we've looked at premeditation. We've looked at the significance of the injury. We looked at whether someone was blindsided or not, whether someone was provoked or not. And we've looked at the different size disparity. I would submit to the court that all of the situations that this court and the Supreme Court has generally relied upon to say the general rule that fists alone are not enough sufficient to meet this level of intent, none of them are here in this case. I mean, that's why I started out this argument by saying I think it comes down to whether that general maxim is still really, really the rule. Because I understand he was angry. I understand that he put him in a headlock and he turned much darker. And I understand, I would, for a slight aside on that, obviously we have to take the trial court's fact findings. I think I argued at trial, and I certainly would have argued in response to the judge's ruling, that that was assuming some facts, not evidence. I think if we get into the scientific realm when we start to say, well, you got this dark, that's what this means. I mean, that's a pretty medical thing to think. I don't know that that's a common sense thing. I certainly don't know that. I don't know when you're this dark, that means this is happening. When you're that dark, that's happening. But that aside, even with that, it's not what we need to look at. They have to rely on the natural and probable consequences of the actions because nothing serious did happen. So where is the evidence that a natural and probable consequence of these actions was to die, to be permanently disabled, permanently disfigured, or maimed? I would submit to the court that's not what this is.
Ask you just as a matter, if the court were to agree with you,
yes, sir,
that this is not unlawful when it was not criminal, you made the point that you're not arguing for a dismissal, you're arguing that it's assault and battery. There's a Supreme Court of Virginia case that says the parties must agree if it's going to be remanded for resentencing on a lesser included offense, that it be only for resentencing and not for a new trial on that. Do I understand that the appellant would agree to that if that's what the court were to do? I'm not saying that's what the court
I understand, Your Honor.
You have authority to do that.
What I have to say at this point is I don't officially have authority to answer that question.
I just wanted to ask that question because I couldn't tell from what you said earlier. Yes, sir.
I guess I'm making the best argument on what I think the law is, to be perfectly honest. I don't know what my client would say.
And I drew you a lifeline so you wouldn't get
I appreciate that, Judge. Well, if you've read the trial transcript, that's certainly where we were trying to head. If there are no other questions, thank you, and we'd ask the court to reverse.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Trent. We will recount.